Hello?
Oh.
Yeah.
Hey.
Okay, perfect.
There we go.
So hopefully right. My sound's okay.
Yep, loud and clear.
Excellent.
All right.
Okay, so we're good to go? Yeah,
go ahead.
Okay, thank you. So thanks so much for coming to see my talk. And sorry that I can't be there in person. So my name is Rose. I'm a programmer at the Layer 1 blockchain for anonymous engineering, which is called DarkFi. We're big fans of Monero, and I've been in the Monero community for a number of years. But in this talk, I'm going to explain kind of three dimensions of the work that we're doing in DarkFi. So the first is about our thesis. So I will explain the kind of macro conditions that I believe are, compelling privacy and anonymity technologies to grow. So it's essentially our bull thesis for anonymous software, including Monero. Then I will briefly reflect on the kind of bigger questions that are at work here. In the first section, we will look at how anonymity allows us to break away from the surveillance state. But the second part of the speech is about, what is the motivation that's driving that effort to decouple from the surveillance apparatus. So it's a bit more of a philosophical segment. And then finally, in the third part of the talk, I will look at DarkFi on a high level, technically, and I will explain, what are the core technical components and how do we use them to create anonymous applications. So to start off, I'll explain our thesis. This is an image of a feedback loop between surveillance and anonymity. As many of you or anyone who's worked in anonymous technology knows, creating anonymous tooling and working in cryptography more broadly is very much a cat and mouse game in which you have to continuously evolve your techniques in order to adapt to an enemy which is also increasingly evolving and becoming more sophisticated. So what we see is the mutual co-development of these two technical spheres, one which is based on surveillance and the other which is based on anonymity. And as each world evolves more technically, the other is forced to also evolve. So, this is a kind of arms race that is present within cryptography. And, it implies that we will see an escalation both in terms of the extensity of surveillance, but also the sophistication of anonymous tooling. So in terms of crypto, I believe these two processes map onto the crypto industry in this way that they become kind of equivalent to what we call RegFi, what we call DarkFi, where this force of surveillance that is creating increasingly advanced surveillance tooling, that maps onto this world of what we call RegFi, whereas DarkFi represents the side of the crypto industry that is concerned with building anti-fragile parallel infrastructure. Keeping in mind the feedback loop that is present, that was discussed in the previous slide, in which we have the mutual co-development of these two spheres of technical research. In the same way, we see a similar divergence happening inside of crypto between RegFi and DarkFi, where regulated crypto is increasingly adapting to the whims of the surveillance state, and DarkFi is decoupling through encryption anonymity from that paradigm and creating a new one beyond the confines of the surveillance state. So, you know, I mentioned briefly this notion of anti-fragility. You may have heard of it before. It gets discussed quite frequently when we talk about cryptocurrency. You know, Bitcoin is often called anti-fragile money. But what we have here is an image which explains the concept. So on the top part of the image, we have an anti-fragile system. So as you can see, it's a positive convexity curve where we have this upward momentum that is not a linear momentum, but actually turns upward at an exponential rate. Similarly, we have the fragile system, which is negatively convex or concave, which is what the kind of primary author of this concept, Nicola Taleb, talks about. He talks about convexity and concave systems, fragile and anti-fragile. And to put it in simple language, an anti-fragile system is something that absorbs shocks and becomes stronger, whereas a fragile system is something that breaks when the external environment becomes increasingly hostile. And crypto today exists on a fragility spectrum. So we have both anti-fragile and fragile projects that are coexisting inside of crypto. So I'll just briefly kind of reflect a little bit more on the kind of nature of this property of anti-fragility. So this diagram is describing a linear relationship between users and time. So this, it basically makes the statement, you know, over time, this graph is accruing more users. So you could say something similar to, like, in terms of our thesis, what we anticipate. So you could say over time, more users will start using privacy software like Monero or DarkFi. However, as we saw in the previous diagram, it's not this linear relationship when we're talking about anti-fragility. It's more like there's something more extreme going on. So, you know, we're looking for a dynamic which is something closer to exponential that integrates feedback loops somehow as part of this, part of its trajectory. So this is a quote which I believe brings us a little bit closer to that exponential dynamic that we're looking for. So some of you may know Jay Stark. Jay Stark was a German Kurdish, visionary who took the 3D printed gun idea that was first introduced by Cody Wilson and kind of brought it to its most simplest and pure version, which was, you know, a weapon that anyone could build using, like, readily available DIY hardware. So he built this highly accessible weapon and was killed by the German state 2 years ago. But this is a quote from him. He says, "If something unfortunate happens to one individual, another individual will take his place. It's a hydra you cannot completely kill. You cut off one head, another pops off. We are impossible to stop." So this beautiful quote, I think, gets us a little bit closer to the kind of dynamic that we're looking for when we talk about anti-fragile systems. And, you know, it brings to mind another kind of idea that comes up, which is a friend described before as the law of insurgencies. So, you know, in an insurgency, if one person is killed, you know, rather than stopping the process, it actually amplifies it and accelerates it. So you have this dynamic where, you know, a revolutionary is killed and 20 more revolutionaries show up to take her place. So that's, again, you know, that's getting a little bit closer to the kind of dynamic that we're talking about when we say anti-fragility. So you may be familiar with Metcalfe's law. This is a law that is, again, used in crypto as a way to potentially value networks. So Metcalfe's law states that the value of a network is equivalent to the number of the users squared. So, you know, that's an exponential relationship and, you know, is a little bit closer to the kind of dynamic that we're looking for when we try to measure and model antifragility. So we propose a version of this Metcalfe's law that we call Jay Stark's law. And this is essentially the same notion, but expanded with the ethics of free software. So, you know, when we talk about free software, what's really interesting is free software puts user empowerment and developer empowerment in positive feedback with each other. So, you know, the users and developers are empowered together in equal proportion. So, you know, we take that ethic, we kind of fuse it with the Metcalfe's law, and we propose this Jay Stark's law, which says user empowerment is positively correlated with system antifragility. And they're actually in positive feedback with each other. So the more empowered a user base, the more anti-fragile a network becomes. And this is key to understanding, you know, why we believe anonymity is going to grow. So the real test of fragile systems and anti-fragile systems is actually the external environment. So when the external environment turns hostile, transparent systems undergo this fragility collapse where users and value kind of flood out from the networks. This is what we expect to happen if, for example, self-custody is made illegal, or crypto is made illegal, or anonymous crypto is made illegal. So, you know, on a fully transparent system where users have liability, you can imagine that they might, you know, in a fragile way, rapidly exit those networks. However, in an anonymous blockchain, the opposite is true. So we find that the more harsh the external environment, the better it actually is for that blockchain. So, you know, far from disincentivizing the use of anonymous software, having regulatory pressure actually increases its justification. So, you know, it kind of underscores the utility of anonymous software. And as well as that, it also starts up a kind of radicalization process where the members of the community are increasingly vindicated in their work. So a good example of this is happened in Tornado Cash on Ethereum, where, you know, there was the OFAC sanction, and instead of, you know, suppressing the use of Tornado Cash, it actually rallied a whole community of ideological people to protect it. And now, recently, the levels of usage have returned to pre-OFAC levels. So, you know, rather than suppressing that software, you know, the harsher regulatory conditions actually increased its utility. So that's what we call the regulation trap. And it's part of this process that we see playing out between anonymous and surveillance-based systems. So, you know, that was a kind of brief overview of like what our thesis is in terms of why we expect the anonymous blockchains like Monero and DarkFi to continuously accrue more users and more value in a way that is not linear, but in fact exponential, and you know, increases within harsh environments. So that was a little bit like our economic macro thesis. But now I will reflect on, okay, so, you know, why make this transition at all? You know, like why cross the bridge to the new anonymous world and leave behind the surveillance based one? So I spoke about several feedback loops that are intrinsic to this process, but you know, I think what's really important to emphasize is that these loops are not static static loops. They don't just, they're just not like a single insulated feedback, which is like circling onto itself in a static way. But it's more like an open spiral. So these anti-fragile networks and ecosystems, they are spiraling outward away from the confines of the surveillance state into this new world of anonymous software. So it's a kind of an exit, like a cybernetic exit from the digital cage of surveillance. And so, you know, that brings to mind the question, yet why are we exiting and what is driving this process? And to answer those kind of questions, it helps to look at philosophy. So I show this image here. Friedrich Nietzsche says something I think that's very wise, where he says that there are different kinds of morality. There's what he calls slave morality and also master morality. And the master basically imposes his morality onto the slave. And the slave, he has this master morality imposed onto him. And he basically, you know, he wants to escape out of that morality that's been imposed on him. So what he does is basically flips the morality upside down, and he creates an inverted version of that morality that is what Nietzsche calls slave morality. So the slave morality is basically the opposite of what the master says is good. And then you armed with this weapon of like a new ideological system, he overthrows the master. But, you know, because the slave has not fully transcended the master and hasn't really escaped those confines that the master has imposed onto the slave, it just perpetuates the cycle of domination, you know, and the cycle of the master-slave dialectic. And the slave hasn't succeeded in actually transcending that ethical paradigm. So Nietzsche says, he warns us against this. He says, you know, we shouldn't be doing simple inverted morality. We should become what he calls philosophers of the future, which are able to create new values that exist beyond that which is imposed by the master onto the slave. And I think that's a really important point, especially because in cypherpunk and in a lot of crypto-anarchist communities, we see a lot of techniques of inversion, subversion, you know, people like thinking about parallel systems, counter economy. And, you know, it's not that it's a bad thing. I think it can be generative, but it's also to be aware that we have to be very conscious of that and try and transcend those that master morality and not fall into the trap of doing a simple inverted repetition that Nietzsche warns us about. And the way that Nietzsche suggests that we become philosophers of the future that can create new values is becoming well-versed and very attuned to the different forces that are present in the world and trying to navigate those forces and analyze them in a process that he calls genealogy, which is, okay, what are the different forces? How do they interact with each other? You know, what is causing them? So you could see the first part of this talk, which was showing the dynamics between anonymity and surveillance as being an attempt towards a kind of genealogy that Nietzsche recommends. So here's another philosopher who says something similar. Abdullah Öcalan, who was the founder of the, or like a key figure in Kurdish revolutionary politics. And so he's been in prison for the past 20 years on an island off of the coast of Turkey, where he's written 5 books. Only the first 3 have been translated from English. But these are 3 concepts that are explained in the 3rd book, which I think also can be used along with Nietzsche's ideas to try to transcend, you know, this dialectic and to create new values beyond the surveillance state. So he says, basically, moral society is inherently moral and political, And what the state does is that it basically attacks society and it separates society from its moral and politics. And so the task of revolutionaries should be to restore that moral and politics that is inherent to society. So he recommends several techniques for this. One is Hui Nazin, which means self-knowledge or know thyself. It's kind of like an inner process of reflection whereby people and communities and societies can reflect on their own roots and origins, you know, and what constitutes them. And, you know, what are their myths? What are their histories? Then Hui Parastin, that means self-defense. That's something which applies to weapons, but not just weapons, but self-defense in a more expansive way, which includes, you know, ideological self-defense, psychological self-defense. And it's part of actually, you know, articulating the contours of a culture and a society. And that's particularly important because one of the ways in which the state perpetuates its kind of stranglehold on society is by seizing its defenses. Finally, then, he talks about the concept of huibun, which is a beautiful word that means several things simultaneously. So it means both self-being or autonomy, but also self-becoming. So it's like the process of becoming autonomous, but also the fact of being autonomous. So that's kind of like the goal of the nation is to, you know, undergo the process or the journey of becoming autonomous and through that achieve a kind of freedom. So this brings me to a pattern that we see sometimes inside of sci-fi, which is which is one of my favorite patterns in science fiction movies. And it involves when a society or culture makes contact with an alien species. A good example is, for example, in The Expanse, where they discover the ring. So it's a moment where you have a relatively stable society that makes contact with some kind of an alien, whether a species or a technology, that completely reconfigures the horizons of the possible. And it kind of permanently overwrites the space of potentialities that are creating the future. So it's this transformative contact of a civilization with something so dramatically exterior and so dramatically beyond the frame of reference that it's a permanent transformation on the part of that society. I think that's a really interesting moment, and I think it's one that we're entering into when we talk about anonymous software, and you know this notion of becoming philosophers of the future beyond the surveillance state. So anonymous engineering is xenotechnics. That means anonymous engineering is alien techniques. And I'm going to explain a little bit briefly on what anonymous engineering is. But if you guys are also attending the remote stage tomorrow, I'd also highly recommend the talk by Amir Taki at 10 a.m. Mexican time, where he will talk more deeply about these concepts. But I will just touch on it lightly here to say that anonymous engineering is a new design space. Which DarkFi is trying to give developers access to. And DarkFi is a L1 for anonymous engineering. So essentially, in the past number of years, there's been a huge amount of innovation in anonymous technologies, ZK, multi-party computation, fully homomorphic encryption, many other tricks and techniques that are being made available to developers for the first time. And so what DarkFi is trying to do is to give developers an environment where they can use those tools to construct anonymous applications. So I will now talk through a few aspects of what is DarkFi technically. So we're different to something like Monero because Monero is a blockchain for money. Fundamentally, it's like Bitcoin, but anonymous. DarkFi is more like Ethereum. It's like Monero, but with smart contracts. So the current status of DarkFi is we're on testnet. It's our first testnet, so it's an alpha. And on there, we have running a anonymous proof of stake called Ouroboros Crypsinus, which allows for an anonymous leader selection. So the whoever is actually creating the blocks is not revealed to the network. We also combine that anonymous proof of stake with a general purpose smart contract infrastructure, which allows us to create and deploy anonymous applications. And we have several apps currently working on the testnet, which are using this infrastructure. For example, we have the world's first anonymous DAO. We have anonymous OTC or atomic swaps. We have the anonymous transactions themselves, staking and unstaking. And finally, we also have a chat app, which I will talk a little bit more about in a moment.
Do you love coffee and Monero as much as we do? Consider making gratuitous.org your daily cup. Pay with Monero for premium fresh beans, and if you like what you taste, send a digital cash tip directly to the farmers that made it possible. Proceeds help us grow this channel, Gratuitous, and Monero.
So to dive a little bit more deeply into how DarkFi achieves generalizable anonymous computation, I will just explain how that works slightly. So on DarkFi network, all full nodes are both provers and verifiers. So the provers are creating the anonymous transactions where they're inputting their secret data. And the verifiers are verifying those transactions and making sure everything's fine at the level of the crypto and also at the signatures. And then they update, they run a state transition function and they update the state with the new transaction that went through. So in terms of generalizability, what's really important on DarkFi is that transactions contain multiple function call data. So call data is just arbitrary data of any kind that is defined by the smart contract. So this data can contain all sorts of things depending on the application. So that could include zero knowledge proofs, signatures, commitments, or anything that your application might require. We're thinking very much in this expanded way where we're not just giving developers access to ZK, but really providing them with many tools to make fully featureful anonymous applications. So these are some dimensions of our smart contract architecture. On the ZK side, we have a virtual machine, which allows us to write circuits using Halo 2, which is the underlying ZK algorithm, which does not require a trusted setup. So it's different to the ZK used by Zcash. So there's no trusted setup. And that's running in a virtual machine. And we also have a assembly language that allows us to write circuits in using that. So that's one aspect that can be used by applications. And then we combine that zero knowledge component with a WASM runtime, which is where we actually deploy the smart contracts and where they actually execute the functions and so on. And these smart contracts that are written in WASM, so they're any WASM compatible language, ours are written in Rust. We also give developers access to a SDK, which is a toolkit where they can make use of signatures, elliptic curve, cryptography, commitments, etc. And we will continue to expand the techniques that developers can access within this toolchain. So I'm just going to quickly look at some of the smart contracts that we have on DarkFi so you guys can get an intuition for how that's working. So here are some smart contract function calls. We have transfer. We have swap. That's how you trade any currency in an atomic peer-to-peer way. And we also have staking and unstaking. These are function calls that are available on the WASM contracts and that can also be used inside of applications. Then, you know, in terms of the DAO, we have a DAO with several steps. These are all working on testnet. So you can create an anonymous DAO. You can anonymously submit a proposal to the DAO. The DAO can vote, and then anyone with the access rights can then execute the proposal by the DAO. That's a quick overview. I will explain a little bit more detail in the next slide. So here we have the DarkFi transaction method. So a nice example of what we call anonymous engineering is actually this method. So it's something called the sapling payment scheme. It is used by Zcash and various other projects as well. And so it's an example of a protocol that allows us to send money around anonymously using these like intelligent cryptographic techniques. So I'm not going to talk through in detail what's happening here. But you know, basically we reveal information, we make proofs and we reveal information in a protocol that determines and enforces the steps and like the flow of events. So it has to be done in like one way and it can't be done in any other way. So it's deterministic and it's kind of an irreversible step-by-step process that cannot be cheated. So, you know, here we have basically two steps. There's like a mint and a burn step. DarkFi, it's at the moment a fully UTXO model, which means we have inputs and outputs similar to Monero. And as you can see here, when we make an anonymous transaction, we're actually creating both a mint proof and a burn proof, where we're actually in our input, we're burning a coin, and in our output, we're minting a coin. And part of this, again, I'm not going to spend too long, is you know we create this secret value called the nullifier, which is allowing for double spend protection. And when we burn the coin in the input, that's actually ensuring that we cannot spend that coin ever again. It's considered spent. I will quickly go through the rest. And I'll just say, like, I don't know if people are watching, if they want to take a photo here, they can actually study. This is like a very simplified version of what's happening in the transaction. So on the left, it explains like first you've got the burn proof and you're minting you have the mint proof, and on the right hand side we have like a simplified version of what both those proofs contain in terms of the protocol. I'm not going to spend too long, so I'll let you guys read that. Okay. Next, I will briefly explain how the DAO works. So the DAO that we have, it's basically the most simplified kind of version of a DAO that you could have. So it's like a very basic primitive DAO, which is intentional. And, you know, there's several steps. So first step is to actually create a DAO. You mint a DAO, which has like a number of settings that you set when you create the DAO, including the proposer limit, a quorum, and the approval ratio. So those settings just determine, okay, how many governance tokens do I need in order to make a proposal? That's one of them. How many tokens need to be, of all the minted tokens, how many tokens need to be voting on this proposal for it to be considered valid? And finally, what is the ratio of yes to no votes in order for that proposal to execute? So you create a DAO and you decide when you create it how you want to, you know, set these different settings. Then basically anyone with sufficient governance tokens can create a proposal to the DAO. And a proposal basically says transfer some amount of tokens to an address specified in the proposal. And the proposal is encrypted and shared with the DAO members. The DAO members then vote on the proposal, and then, you know, anyone calls this function, anyone with the access rights calls the function exec, and that will, you know, enforce that, okay, is it within the proposal limit? Is the quorum accepted? And, you know, what is the approval ratio? And then depending on whether that passes all the checks, the proposal will execute, which means money will be sent from the DAO wallet to the wallet specified in the proposal. So this is a mechanism by which we can anonymously, in a collective way, make decisions about the spending of a treasury. So that's really powerful. And what's interesting also, because of the way that DarkFi is built, is that you can actually use this as a form of on-chain protocol-owned liquidity, which means you can build applications that can spend from a treasury in an anonymous way according to logic that you write inside of that, according to on-chain logic that you specify inside an application. So that's potentially very powerful. And it's just one of the apps that we've built, and we plan to build many more such apps. So, you know, back to the kind of basic overview of DarkFi, and I will be wrapping up very quickly. So, you know, DarkFi also has a peer-to-peer component. So we use a peer-to-peer network. And the way that it's been built is to be like intentionally modular and simple so that we can easily plug in other kind of anonymity layers. So we have support for NIM, for Tor and TLS. You can optionally choose how you want to anonymize your network traffic. So we're the only project at the moment that is offering support for this and network level anonymity, which is so important. Then, you know, we also put a big emphasis on anonymous developer communication. So we built our own chat application, which is a fully anonymous peer-to-peer chat. We have, as you can see here, this is our dev chat. Every Mondays at 4 o'clock Central European time, we have a meeting. We also have encrypted channels, encrypted DMs. You can change your nickname as many times as you want. So it's highly anonymous and it's fully peer-to-peer. It's basically IRC that's been reconfigured to work in a peer-to-peer context and with these additional anonymity features. And so we use this as our primary developer coordination. We also have a task management system, which is peer-to-peer and anonymous. And we're planning to migrate away from GitHub so that our developers can work on DarkFi in a way that is fully anonymous, deniable, and peer-to-peer. So, you know, in terms of the current status, we are on testnet. We're currently stabilizing this release. We're also doing simulations to figure out what is the token going to be, like, you know, what are the block rewards going to be, what is the fees. So everything related to token and fees is currently being tested and simulated. And so the next release, we will deploy a testnet, which has a more advanced fee model and also has a token and with proper rewards, etc. So that's the next testnet. And then once that's running, we're going to have the audit. So we will audit all the different aspects of the code base. Once then we finish the auditing phase, we will deploy mainnet. The current timeline for that is end of year, but really it depends on how long the audit takes because, you know, that could create additional work for us. So that's it. Please, again, feel free to take a picture or a screenshot of this slide. Check out our website. You've got everything on there. You know, it has a link to our docs, which explains many things that I explained in more detail. Check out our Twitter and also feel free to visit our GitHub. But mostly, if you really want to talk with us and you're interested, Come on Mondays at 4 o'clock to the dev meeting on our anonymous IRC. There's instructions in the docs on how to set up the IRC. It's really good and fun. And it's honestly the best chat available on the market. And it's a really good portal to the DarkFi community and network as well. So that's it. Thanks very much for coming to my talk. And sorry I couldn't be there in person. Bye.
That was so great. Oh my God. I took a look at the slides earlier and I knew it was going to be great. And that did not let me down. All right. I'm going to try my best to juggle the questions that appear in chat with the microphone, as I've just been informed there's a microphone in that room that you guys are welcome to use. And there's supposed to be a camera up, but it seems to have just gone down. For a while, the camera wasn't working because the dongle was stolen, and then it was up, and now it's down. I don't know what's happening, but if the camera doesn't come back up and there aren't people who I can see who are ready to speak, then we're just going to have to try our best to have anybody who wants to ask questions on the microphone, please just feel free to interject whenever is appropriate. All right, I can already see a bunch coming in here. Rosa, are you here to take questions?
Yeah, I can take a few questions for sure.
Okay, just a few. All right. One says, I can see how harsher regulations will galvanize those already in the choir, but won't it discourage those who are more, not less?
Yeah, I mean, I think what I'm banking on is that there's a kind of tipping point where, you know, even people who are at the moment, you get a lot of people saying like, oh, like, why would I care about privacy? You know, I don't have anything to hide. And I do think there's like a tipping point of authoritarianism where like even those people want to be private at some point. So like, you know, an example would be China, where pretty much everyone uses VPN. So I do think there's a tipping point, but also we're very much interested in like what you said, the kind of the choir, in the sense of like building better tools for those groups and people that are already like needing this software, but that are currently underserved. So we believe that there is a market for this that exists, you know, even among like kind of a more niche crowd. But we want to serve that market because we believe it's big and underserved. And actually, you know, Monero is a kind of indicator of the market that's kind of latent and ready to be tapped into.
Yeah, definitely. Here's one. How does the anonymity model, man, I cannot speak today, guard against imposters, bad actors, and inflation?
Well, inflation. Oh, infiltration. Yeah. Infiltration. Yeah. Because I was going to say that in terms of inflation, like the supply is known of the coin, but in terms of infiltration on the DAO, you know, it's something which, so we worked on the Assange DAO, which was last year. We raised over 50 million and the goal was free Assange by all means necessary. That was the mission statement. But then, you know, when it came to it, like it was very difficult because we were coordinating in public to free an enemy of the state. And there were loads of concerns about, you know, the DAO being sabotaged by infiltrators. So I don't think that having an anonymous DAO makes it necessarily any less liable to more or less liable to capture by any actor that might want to, you know, destabilize the DAO. As soon as you're kind of coordinating in an online decentralized way, you're going to introduce those kind of attack vectors. So I would say that like it depends on each DAO what the kind of threat model of the DAO is. So I could totally imagine a DAO which is just like a group of 10 people. They all know each other personally. And, you know, they have this like very robust kind of security where they don't just let random people into the DAO. It's just like those guys that are, they're just managing their thing. But you could also imagine like more public DAO. So something like a Sanj DAO, which anyone can join. So that would be like a different story. But then you have to kind of distinguish between like anonymous in terms of the on-chain and anonymous in terms of like the forums and the IRC, you know, or wherever you happen to be like the communication part of the DAO. So, you know, as we have on ETH at the moment, it's like everything on the blockchain side is completely transparent, but then you have like these chat rooms where you don't really know who you're talking with. So yeah, we're basically making that more extreme because we're providing better anonymous tooling on both sides, like in on the coordination communication side, but also on the blockchain side. I think the blockchain one is like especially important because without that, you're really just like doxing your behavior and balances to the whole world. And, you know, to just wrap up on the kind of on the thread related to Assange DAO, we raised all this money and then we entered into an NFT auction. It was like part of the kind of DAO mission was to like buy this NFT. And what ended up happening was because our max bid was known on chain that we had 50 million on our treasury, there was no one who was willing to bid against us. It created like a very inorganic market environment where there was no bids. And, you know, it really made us realize that actually you need anonymity for markets and, you know, for auctions, for many kind of game theoretical scenarios, you require information asymmetry. So that was very illuminating. And what ended up happening was we were pressured to put a max bid, so send all the money, and move basically that money that got sent to the NFT was then moved into a off-chain foundation. And, you know, that was the Assange family who wanted to do that because they were so worried about like state level attacks where basically the DAO would be infiltrated. So yeah, that's, you know, it's a concern. I think different DAOs will have to deal with their own OPSEC and InfoSec according to their use case, basically.
Yeah, I think this is so fantastic. I think the future of decentralized infrastructure not only needs to be trustless by default, but also anonymous and maybe opaque or dark, as you might call it. Because then on top of that, if that's the default, then you can build whatever amount of trust and transparency and identity on top of that. With all the examples that you gave of DAOs doing, you know, whatever things that they want to do, it's really hard to build, something on top of a totally transparent chain that has any degree of, you know, anonymity. So, yeah, this is so fantastic. Thank you so much. There is one more. Would you like to take one more?
Yeah, I'll happy to take one more.
Sure. Why don't we see the radicalization you describe already happening today? There have been so many stories of privacy infringements, data collecting, etc., but people seem unmoved generally.
Yeah, I mean, yes and no. It is very disconcerting how kind of numb people are. And I think there's a really great book called by Shoshana Zuboff called Surveillance Capitalism. And in that she talks about something she calls the dispossession cycle, which is like how in the course of like since the 2000s, so in the last like 20 years, we have become like as a society, especially in the West, kind of increasingly numb and normalized to the idea of like, you know, constant surveillance. And she kind of tries to analyze how did that come about? And like, you know, why did how are these like companies, etc., through marketing or propaganda or through their philosophy, able to convince people that giving up their information is a good thing? And so, you know, and just to be just completely numb and normalized by the level of data extraction. So I think we have seen that happen. And, you know, it is a bit concerning, especially when I hear a lot of people saying also in crypto that privacy is losing the meme war, in the sense that privacy is like, it loses the meme war because the kind of counter argument to privacy is always, why would I need privacy if I'm not doing something bad? And just the very kind of framing of that question, like, hijacks the kind of latent, you know, the kind of latent, like the natural latent kind of ness of hiding information. And it just, it creates this notion, it kind of forces this notion that, like, you know, everything should be automatically transparent and anything else is like illegal or like, you know, or like evil. But yeah, so I do think this is like a meme problem, and we've tried to go the other way, where like, firstly, like leading into the notion that like actually it's like privacy is not, you know, Zcash, they say privacy is normal, but we prefer like the Monero thing, which is like, no, like privacy is scary, you know, privacy is powerful, and it's something abnormal, it's something like, it's something alien and something empowering, and that's going to change everything. And really, you know, what we're trying to do with DarkFi is also to make it into a positive narrative, which is not just about, you know, subverting the regime, but actually establishing a new one. So, you know, there's like an affirmation there. It's not simply like a negative project, but it's actually about world building. And I think that narrative has potential to grow beyond the kind of more traditional like cypherpunk core, given that it has this like this affirmation. However, I would also say that we don't need everyone to agree or support our mission in order for it to succeed. Like the history of revolutions is always the history of like a small focused minority acting, you know, sometimes against the wishes of like a majority demographic that is often complicit with the oppressor. So, you know, I think I agree and et cetera, but there is a certain degree that like this tech will, it is going to happen. It is happening and it will happen irrespective of the support of the mainstream people. However, I will just say also quickly before I finish, in terms of the radicalization process, I do think it is happening in crypto itself a little bit more since the Tornado Cash thing. So Tornado Cash happened. If you like go onto the Telegram group, it was very interesting what happened then, because, you know, I was expecting like people to like, oh, I can't use this Telegram group because it's like illegal. But actually it was like super active. And everyone was writing there. They were all sharing like how to access Tornado Cash, like from, you know, decentralized RPC providers, and, you know, redeploying it on IPFS and redeploying the GitHub. So there was a kind of rallying of the community. And I think in, at least on the Ethereum side, we've seen many more people coming out in support of privacy that previously were not as vocal about it. So, you know, there has been some kind of assertment of values inside of crypto, that's for sure. But I don't know if it extends to the broader public. It doesn't seem to, at least at the moment.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think technology long ago passed the rate of change needed for humanity to just not be able to adapt, find new wisdom for it at all. And we're still trying to figure out, it's strange how we're still trying to figure out that we actually do value privacy in so much of our cultures, not just our Western one, but around the world, you know, rely on the presumption that, you know, when we you know, speak to each other in the confines of our own home. There's real privacy there and not like an Alexa listening to us and whatnot. Yeah, it's just, I find it really interesting. Yeah, you definitely made a great point that resonated with me when you mentioned how people, to counter that argument, will often say things like, well, I have nothing to hide. Yeah. Well, if there are no other questions, that was fantastic. Thank you so much for presenting, Rose. That was so great.
Thank you for having me. Sorry I couldn't be there. I hope you guys have a wonderful weekend.